So thanks, Yair. I just want, before I start, to thank my sponsors from the NSF and from another grant which is related to my days back in Yale University. I'll speak today, it will actually be more of a tutorial compared to other talks today, and I'll talk about the relationship between diffusion spaces and pattern recognition. And by pattern recognition, we refer to the following task. We are given a certain training set, which is usually a large data set on which we can do certain computations offline. Okay, now given those computations, which in electrical engineering jargon we call them optimization, computation, etc., in machine learning we call them learning. So that's the set on which we are going to do those computations, and then at a later point of time we'll get a new set. Usually it is much smaller than the training set on which we would like to infer certain properties. So this is what we call pattern recognition. Those properties might be a certain classification or a certain or a numerical value of a property related to that new test set. So one of the state-of-the-art tools nowadays in such tasks are spectral embeddings. And this relates to a large class of numerical algorithms which provide several interesting properties which are useful for pattern recognition. The first is that they allow us to compute efficient dimensionality reduction. Then in particular, a particular class of them called diffusion maps allow us also to do this, to reduce the dimensionality in a special form, which I will refer later in this density invariant embeddings, which is quite important in certain pattern recognition applications. And then also, and I think that Jan Lacon referred to that in his talk, they also provide a very natural embedding operator in the following sense that given a training set on which we learn something, computed, whatever we had to compute, we need to have a certain numerical mean to extend this knowledge to the training set. So I'm trying to show that there is a very natural numerical algorithm for doing that. And the outline of this talk will be the following. I'll present very shortly what are spectral embeddings, and then I'll show several approaches to interpreting them. So most of them will look the same, but there are different ways of viewing them and analyzing them. And then for each view or point of view, actually, we can derive different pattern recognition algorithms. So that would be the outline. And I'll start with the more classical one, which is the geometrical approach, which views dimensionality reduction as some reduction of dimensions while retaining certain geometrical properties in Rn. Then I'll move to diffusion distances, which is more related to viewing spectral embeddings as some kind of, or actually the result of inducing some artificial Markov walk on our data. Here we'll have some kind of mean cut, and I'll move to the second part of the talk. In the second hour, where I'll discuss certain properties of spectral embeddings as being able to produce adaptive bases to data sets. Then, based on those adaptive bases, we will be able to extend certain functions over a data set and also over the training set to that mean. And then we will be able also to derive a pattern recognition scheme which are based on this adaptive bases. The last part is not purely related to spectral embedding, but it's more related to relaxation of certain quadratic optimization problems. And this is something I've started doing, studying quite recently. And I will show that it, although it's related to spectral embedding, that it provides a very interesting mean of computing the similarity between sets of points in Rn, also finding the assignments between two sets or graphs to that extent, and also has some applications in pattern recognition. So that's the outline. Now we'll go here. So I just want to acknowledge my collaborators, Ronald Koifon, with whom I've been for 3 years back at Yale, Stefan Lafon, who's now in Google, Amit Zinger, who sits in the crowd, is also in Yale nowadays, Steven Zucker from Yale, and Michael Chertok, who is my student back in Babylon. So the first point to start with is to recognize that high-dimensional data is difficult when we try to apply pattern recognition techniques to it. I mean, if we go back to very traditional techniques which apply dimensional density estimation to the data, we'll see that if the dimensionality of the data goes beyond n equals 3 and equals 4 and so forth, it becomes numerically difficult, practically sometimes impossible. Also, other traditional algorithms like FFT or other transforms like the Weber transforms, when they are applied to signals of high dimensionality, they are quite exhausting. Now, so these are the difficulties. Luckily for us, approximately here, we have some reasons to assume or to believe that actually we can reduce the dimensionality of the data. So although the data is given in some high dimensional representation, this example, the data is given in R3, but you can see that it actually lies in a low dimensional manifold. So we have some reasons to assume that certain signals, and I'll show some more practical examples later, are actually reside on a small dimensional manifold. And the reason that we acquire them in some high dimensional representation is only a matter of acquisition. And if we reduce the dimensionality, actually we'll be able to find some intrinsic representation of them. And as we said, this kind of high dimensional representation actually sometimes obscures the real structure of the data. And the last thing, which is the last reason, which is actually the most important one, is that for many applications, actually the fact that once we compute a low dimensional representation, we induce a lot of distortion is not an issue. For instance, consider a problem of identifying a person. So we can associate terabytes of data to each person. Think about the DNA, data records, government records, etc. But if I just want to recognize a particular person, all I need is a social security number. So this thing tells us, and actually in many applications, we won't need the entire data or a complete representation. So inducing a distortion while reducing the dimensionality is actually okay. You just have to do it the right way, although the distortion is actually significant. So just to give you a more practical example that I'll run through all of this tutorial, and this is something we used in some of our papers. So consider an audio-visual sequence. So you have a person speaking and you have both his lips and also the audio recording. And now we just break up this recording into segments. So we synchronize the video frames and the audio signal. So for each, so this is like 25 frames per second. So we synchronize such that for each image of the lips, we have the corresponding audio sequence. So this is an example of a high dimensional signal. I mean, the video itself is about 1600 large, and the audio frames are about 16,000 and 1200. And what we aim to recognize here is a simple example, is to be able to recognize when the person says 0 to 1. Just identify the digits. Okay, so here we have a problem, and the underlying manifold is much lower. So although each sample is of high dimensional space, actually the number of states is much lower. Yeah, I keep missing the button. So I just added this slide because so many people have talked about random projections. So from my point of view, as a person who does not study random projections, what they actually provide is a tool that limits what I would call the dynamic range of high dimensional data nowadays. So you could find old papers talking about special algorithms for having the data which is like 500K, 600K, a million of dimensions. But nowadays, because we have fast algorithms based on the Lindershaw-Johnson lemma, in practice, if you are given a data which is 500K in dimension, you don't really care about it because immediately you can compute a very fast dimensionality reduction up to order of 10 to the power of n of 10 to the power of 4. So this is not the general case. There might be some data sets in which this is inapplicable. But in general, it means that actually nowadays we always deal with this kind. If it's really a very high dimensional data set, you can always reduce it. And this kind of logic also can be seen in papers about metric trees and so on. Okay, so now nowadays we know that high dimensional data begins somewhere around 100 dimension, goes up to, let's say, 10 to the fifth. Even if you have something which is of dimension 100K, you can always reduce it. So the Linderson-Johnson algorithm allows us to reduce dimensionality, as I said, from very high dimensional data to what else are called mediocre dimensionality. So what's wrong with it? The main issue is that it preserves L2 distances or LP distances if you have a certain variation of it. So that's not very useful for many pattern recognition applications. And that's like the textbook example. Look at this data set. So I have this person turning his head up and down, left and right. And if you look at the L2 distances, you'll see that they do not provide any means of understanding the dynamics of this system. So obviously there are two parameters here. One left and right, and one up and down. Maybe it's not up, actually even doing up and down. It might be that this is only a one-dimensional manifold. So it's clear for us to see. But if you use L2 distances to analyze this data directly, you won't get it. Why? Because the L2 captures the extrinsic dimensionality of this data set. So each image here would be of order 10 to the power of 4. So that's actually useless. So what we're actually looking is for a way to compute the intrinsic dimensionality of the data, or more accurately, a representation of that intrinsic dimensionality. So just to go over this sentence, if you compute the L2 distance between this image and that image and that image, they're meaningless. All they tell you is that the distance is very large, but they are not meaningful in the sense that the distance to this position might be in L2, might be larger than the one to this position, but it basically says nothing about the positions of these images on this one-dimensional manifold, which is the rotation of the head. Okay? So therefore, what we see also is that only in the vicinity of each point, the L2 distance is meaningful. So the idea with many of these kind of algorithms is to compute local distances in L2 and then agglomerate. So I'll start with a general description of kernel methods. I mean, I'm going to skip a lot of reference and so on because I have a lot of stuff to cover. So if you feel that I missed something important, please let me know. And the basic idea is the following, that given a certain data set of size and with a certain dimensionality, we can apply a positive semi-definite kernel to that data set. So when we talk about the kernel, usually we distinguish between two parts in it. The first part is the distance metric defined over the data set, the distance metric D. This is, in practical application, highly related to the particular type of data that we are going to use. Okay, so one will not use the same distance measure for images and for audio signals or for psychological data and so forth. Each application calls for its own similarity measure, or in this case, distance measure. The kernel that we use is, in this case, I just use the Gaussian kernel without the term here. And you can use a wide range of kernels. It comes out that for this kind of analysis that we do here, it's not really important the kind of kernel you use, so you can always use the Gaussian. In statistical literature, there is a lot of discussion of different kernels in density estimation. Here, because we, in a few lines, we'll go to the asymptotic regime, it's not really important.
And it's the square.
Excuse me?
Square.
It's not, so, yeah, but you can put it in. Huh? I'm trying to say that it's not, that it's really, okay. So to be very formalistic, like you all suggested, we always have some square here. I mean, the distance measure is positive also. Positive is positive, but might also be zero. Okay. So the next thing after we form this affinity matrix W is to compute the eigenvectors of this affinity matrix. And the nice property of this embedding is that we can relate the L2 distances in the embedding space. I mean, we have this new set of coordinates, which I'll tell you in a second what they are. We can relate the distance in this new set of coordinates to the original space. That's like the focal point of using kernels. And just to tell you about what are the new coordinates, the eigenvectors of this matrix are treated as the new set of coordinates. So say we started with n points, w is n by n, then the eigenvectors are each of length n. So for instance, the fifth entry in each eigenvector contributes or is the new coordinate of the fifth entry of xi. Okay? So once we have this new set of coordinates, the important property is that they are somehow related to the original space. Why is that important? Because now if we choose the appropriate kernel, we can induce the appropriate metric over the original space. Okay, so instead of measuring certain L2 distances over the original space, we can embed and then be able to measure other metrics which are more important or more practical for certain applications. So, and kernel methods have been used quite intensely over the last 10 years in machine learning. I mean, it probably goes back many years back. I mean, I think Amin told me about a paper from 82 using something related to diffusion maps. So, So there are many works on that. The main issue, the main difference between different works is first the use of the kernel. Different approaches use different kernels. Lately, there has been one predominant kernel, which is the graph Laplacian used in pattern recognition. And after it was decided that that's like the optimal one, we see different approaches to analyzing, to interpreting what are the results of the embedding. And then based on that, we can derive different algorithms. Okay, so the first approach I'll discuss is what I consider a geometric approach. It was suggested by Belkin and Ayogi from the University of Chicago, and it's called Laplacian eigenmaps. And it views spectral embeddings with a particular kernel that I'll show in a second as a way of embedding high-dimensional data while preserving a certain geometrical measure. So here, they don't claim to have a particular metric which is induced on the data. They just show that if we would like to minimize, so f is my dimensionality reduction operator. So if I want to minimize the distortion of the geodesic distance over the manifold, so the distance between two points after I compute their low dimensional representation will be smaller or in the same order of the geodesic distance over the manifold of in the original data set. So they are just retaining infinitesimal distances between points which are close by. As I said before, that's the focal point of analyzing high dimensional data while we assume that there is some kind of manifold there. We just analyze short distances. Then, if you run through the proof, this is just a summary. So I just summarize like a page and a half into like three lines. It comes out that in order to achieve that, there is a natural choice of a kernel. And that kernel is the graph Laplacian. Just go back one slide, actually two slides, and show you that this matrix W, which is a symmetric positive semi-definite matrix, can also be viewed as a graph. So which kind of graph is it? Is it, it is simply an undirected graph with positive weights. So we can view our data first as being some affinity matrix W, but then we can also view it as a graph. So these are dual points of view. And it comes out naturally that if we choose the graph Laplacian as our kernel and compute its eigenvectors over the data, then we derive a new set of coordinates which minimize this geometrical distortion measure. Okay. So in order to to continue with pattern recognition, I'll just add a few more tools which were found to be important here. And the next thing is to consider the density invariant embedding. So what's the problem of density invariance in spectral embeddings? The issue is like that. Say we have a certain point which is part of two different sets. So by two different sets, I mean that both of them are high-dimensional data in, having the same low-dimensional manifold, but each time, each set, one here and one here, has a different density, meaning that there are different points here and here over the same manifold. So it is, I won't say easy, but it is very easy just to see it by some but by a simple experiment to see that the same point will not be embedded into the same low-dimensional presentation in both cases. In other words, the spectral embedding highly depends on the density of the points in the set which is being embedded. And that's, in many cases, would be a problem with pattern recognition, because it means that the same operation in which we reduce the dimensionality of a set will not be the same if we use different sets. So the same point will be mapped to different coordinates. So if, for instance, you want to recognize the point after some time, it will be difficult. Why? Because it will be mapped to different coordinates just because the density of the set is different. So for that, Stefan Lafont and Rafi Koifman suggested the Laplace-Beltrami normalization. And that normalization says the following thing. If we normalize our kernel just by computing a very simple estimate of the density, this is what you have here, the density of each point. And if you normalize your graph using the weights because Wij is the distance between two points. Okay, so point I and point J. So if you just normalize by the density of both points, you get a density invariant representation. What does it mean that it is density invariant? It means that you'll get the density as if, you'll get the embedding as if the density of the sets was uniform. So if I'll go back and look at it here, so when I embed different sets with the same points, it will normalize the density of each set, and I'll receive the same set of coordinates exactly for the same points in both sets. So this allows us to overcome one of the problems with spectral embedding. Okay, so for those of you who like geometry, so the classical example that Stefan used in his papers is that if we have a closed curve in some three-dimensional space with variable density along the curve. This is the density along the curve. It's the same color. So if you use the regular graph Laplacian, you will not get a circle. A circle is the natural embedding of a closed curve with uniform density. But if you take such a curve with varying density and apply the Laplace-Beltrami, we get back the circle. It means that if we take two different curves with varying density, both will be embedded into the circle. Okay? And this is what we were looking for, to be able to compute a canonical representation of our data, which is first has smaller dimensions, but then is also invariant to the density of the points.
Is that supposed to be a square root of Q1?
No, it's just like
this. Do you write the sum or the square root of the
sum? It's the sum. Let me check it later. Okay.
Because, I mean, you would take
I think at first it seems that it has to be a square root, I think. But let me check. Square root? No? Let us check it later. So now, and also, as I said, Jan referred to that in his talk, we need to have an out-of-sample extension operator. So what is an out-of-sample extension operator? It says the following thing. Say we have our learning set. Say it is like 10,000 strong. And then, So we compute the embedding and everything. We have all of the low dimensional representation we need. But then we are given a new point, the 10,001st point. So how will we know the embedding coordinates of this new point? So obviously we can just take this large set of 10,001 points and do it all over, but that's not what we're looking for. We're looking for a fast algorithm to extend the embeddings from what we already know, which I will call in pattern recognition the learning set, to this new point, which is the test set. So luckily for us, there is such an extension, and actually it is based on a well-known tool from matrix analysis. It's called the Nystrom extension, and it was already used in computer vision by Malik's group when they extended the eigenvectors of a positive semi-definite matrix for computing the mean cut over images. So here we're using a different version of that. I'll try to show you what it means. So the basic Nystrom extension has nothing to do with pattern recognition. It's just a way of extending eigenvectors of positive semi-definite matrices. So that's the basic equation. And the idea is that initially, if you just think of your original set, you can just write this equation as the equation of the eigenvalues and eigenvectors of that particular matrix. And now I'll divide by 1 over lambda L for a particular eigenvector. And then we will utilize the fact that the kernel can be extended beyond the original set X. It can also be estimated at a new point Y, which is beyond X. Okay? So this gives us a way of extending eigenvectors of such matrices. So what's the idea? The idea, now, which goes beyond just using this extension scheme as used by Malik's group. It goes like that. When we analyze the data, we will choose the bandwidth parameter, the bandwidth of our Gaussian, what we call epsilon or sigma, to be as small as possible. The reason being that we would like our analysis to concentrate on the local geometry of the data. Now, when we come up and would like to extend this embedding to a new point, we actually don't want to analyze data anymore. We just want to extend. This means that what we would like to have is a much larger bandwidth. Moreover, there is no reason to extend the original matrix as used before. We can choose any positive kernel defined over the set and extend it. We don't have to extend the original kernel because, as I said before, the original kernel will naturally have a very small bandwidth. So it is difficult to extend. Now just provide a simple example. Those who are used to density estimation with kernels just might think that if the original set looks like that, and what I'm doing here actually is putting, let's say, Gaussians, if my kernel is Gaussian, I'm putting Gaussians here. So after about 3 sigma, there is no interaction between my new point and the old set of points. So it's obvious that for extension, I'd like to have this sigma of the kernels as large as possible. So it cannot be too large, but yet, I'll show later why, but yet it will be much larger than the bandwidth of the kernels used for analysis. So what we did is the following. We defined a new kernel over the data. It is much easier to use a non-normalized kernel. If you look at Malik's work, there is a very nice way of defining a normalized graph Laplacian kernel over the original data, and then being able to compute it over the extended data. Here we don't have to do it because this property is valid for any positive semi-definite kernel. So we define what we call an extension kernel with this larger bandwidth, extend it from the original set X to the new point Y, and now we can extend any function we want over the data set. Later I'll use it to do pattern recognition directly. For now, all we'll do is use this new set of eigenvectors which were extended, which are the eigenvectors of the extension kernel, to extend the original embedding. Okay, so what we have here are two sets of kernels. The graph Laplacian one, which is used to analyze the data and has certain properties, and then there is an extension kernel, which is only used to extend those embeddings into the new point. So, let me show you here. Just look at the extension. So what we see is that we have this 1 over lambda L term. This means that when I compute this extension operator, I cannot extend too many eigenfunctions. Why? Because the spectrum of these operators and matrices is usually decaying. Not usually, it's always decaying. The rate of decay depends on sigma. But it means that at some point, for some 1 over, for some L, I will not be able to use one, I will not be able to compute this term because it will be unstable. So this provides us with a natural limit, a natural limit of how much we can extend. So just to give you the intuition, the first few eigenfunctions of this kind of kernels correspond to functions with low frequency. So basically, the highest the higher the order of the eigenfunction and eigenvalue, you get eigenfunctions with higher frequency content. So it says something which is very natural in signal processing. It is what all we are able to extend are low pass functions. At some point of time, the frequency content will have to be cut. Okay. So also it means that when we use this kind of low pass extension algorithm, it is low pass not in the Fourier sense that we have in electrical engineering, but more in eigenfunctions of positive semi-definite operators, we will not be able to extend very complex functions. All we will be able to extend are quite simple functions. And it's very, I mean, in machine learning, there are many works that introduce an MDL. MDL is a mean description length, which means that when we try to learn something, we put some kind of limit on the complexity of our learning. So it's interesting to see that here this kind of MDL criteria comes out very naturally. You cannot extend too much. Or in other words, we cannot learn very complicated functions and then extend them because we are limited here. We have some work on ways to overcome this, but still too early. So, just a few words about the width of the extension kernel, which I said before. If we take a very small, a very narrow kernel, then our approximation, the approximation of the function that we intend to extend would be quite good because we have a lot of high frequency eigenfunctions that we can use. The problem is that the extension, the range of extension, as I said here, would be rather small because this circle of three sigma would be somewhere here. So with this kind of choice, we can do interpolation. For instance, if you have 60,000, a learning set of 60,000 samples, and you believe that all of your test samples would be very close to the samples you already have, then you can choose a kernel which is very narrow. And that would be okay. Actually, it would be very good because then your approximation is good and you don't need to go very far from each test sample to the nearest point in your learning set. But if your learning set is rather small and you believe that some of the test samples would be far away from your learning set, if they are too far, then you cannot extend at all. But if instead of 60,000 samples you have like 10,000 or 5,000, then we'll take epsilon, which is much larger, and then we will be able to do extrapolation of our embedding, not only interpolation. And then our approximation would be poor. So there is a trade-off, and in Lafons and Koefman paper called geometric harmonics, it provides a complete analysis of this algorithm, but also it deals directly with this trade-off. You can see the trade-off here. Exactly. Approximation versus extension. That's a trade-off. So they provide a simple algorithm of iteratively changing epsilon such that it achieves two given thresholds. One threshold is given for the approximation, and the other one is for the extension. So the next part of the workshop is called massive data sets. So I recently ran into massive data sets. And then once you start trying to deal with them, we see that there are two numerical workhorses which are used in this line of work. The first one is the Gauss transform. All of these computations of kernels and so forth are actually variants of what we call the Gauss transform. We compute the interaction between points using a particular kernel. That's for the embedding. The nice thing here is that this is usually done offline in most applications, but it might happen that we have an application where we have to rapidly learn something. But in general, this is not an issue of runtime. And then we have the SVD. So if you run into data sets of until about 50K, it's easy to do in MATLAB. Beyond that, we really need the kind of algorithms that Mark Tigert and Gunnar showed us here. And the extension algorithm is again the Gauss transform. So a few words of what can be used. So I talked about that. About the Gauss transform, that's the more difficult item comes out to be. So the FMM and the fast Gauss transform and improved Gauss transform from a group in Maryland, they scale badly with the dimensionality. And the thing which I found most interesting is the dual trees approach by Andrew Moore and Alexander Gray. He is now in Georgia Tech. And that's a way of first analyzing massive data sets in trees and then computing the fast Gauss transform using trees. And it becomes really interesting. I mean, this work stems from work on approximate nearest neighbors, but the dual tree becomes very interesting if we have to recognize large data sets. So if you just have if you have some data set which is a learning set and your training, your test set is very small, you can just use regular computations. The interesting thing becomes if you have a massive data set which you have learned, say 1 million, and then you have to recognize 100K samples. So the idea there is then to build two trees, one on the learning set and then one on the test set. And the results are very interesting. In particular, they show experimentally that these approaches are very difficult to utilize in high dimensional data. So now I've showed you three tools. Low dimensional embedding, which has some geometric properties. Density invariant embeddings, which means that I can now take two data sets which have the same manifold but different densities and get the same embedding, and an extension algorithm. So I'll just use the first two for this example, which we did with Stefan and Koifman back in Yale. And the idea is the following. We are given three data sets that are high dimensional, let's say about 10K or 20K large. And then both of them as a set of high dimensional signals. I mean, I don't care about this being an image. This is just a vector of very high dimension, not space. And and the three of them correspond to the same manifold. The manifold is very simple. The three person, some of you may recognize a few of them, just rotate their heads left and right, up and down. So what is the manifold here? The manifold is a very abstract notion. But in this case, it is just the set of possible states. So it's exactly the same set of states in both cases because we have rotating heads. And although this and this are not the same person, we assume that the human head has the same set of rotating states across these two people. Okay? Obviously, when we take these video sequences, the density is different because each of these people rotates the heads differently, arbitrarily. The density is not the same. And what we wanted to show here is that if we just reduce the dimensionality and then compute a density invariant embedding, we can actually align very different data sets just by doing that. And yeah, so let me just show it here. This demo, I have to give credit to Stefan. He did it in Flash, and in a second I'll be able to show you. Yeah, so this is the, so once we down project, we compute a dimensionality, reduced representation, which is density invariant, then what we get is a representation which only depends on the manifold. Now the manifold is the same. Therefore, once we align both set of points, the alignment was not done in 2D, it was done in 7D, but once we do that, you see that we can align different information sources. Yeah.
Sure. Was the alignment done unsupervised, or was there
supervised? So first, you compute the reduced dimensionality representation of the data, which is density invariant. Then we choose we chose a few anchor points, and a few anchor points.
But how many roughly?
Well, let's say about 10. I think it's
6 actually.
Oh, because we did this. What?
Wasn't it 6?
No, because we use this course. Actually, do not remember. It goes back like 2 years. But the idea is that once you have a few anchors, either you do it in some high dimensional space like 7 or 8, or you do it in a low dimensional space and then you have some redundancy and use these squares. Okay? And there are a few variants of that we can talk later about doing the alignment in very high dimensional space like 15 and then projecting back into 3. Never mind. So here we did the same thing with LIPS. So we took the LIPS data, embedded it, and now we're able to synchronize different data sources. Now, I must say that for a person, it's really easy to understand that these two positions are the same, but this is a way of doing that automatically. So now let's do a little bit of free pattern recognition. So now, I will not require the density invariant embedding. All I just need is low dimensional embedding and then an extension operator. That's all I'm going to use. So I would like to recognize those digits, 0 to 9. So the first thing to do is to learn the manifold. So what is a manifold? A manifold is this low dimensional representation of all the possible states of a person speaking. In that sense, let's for a minute just concentrate on the visual data. So this is all of the possible states of the positions that a person's mouth might take. So we split this pattern recognition algorithm into two parts. The first part is to learn the manifold, and only in the second part, I'll tell him what he's going to learn specifically. So first we learn what are all possible states. Only then we mark those who are relevant to identify certain digits. So the way to do that is just to give a certain person a newspaper, and then just has to read an article for 5 minutes. It has nothing to do with the digits at all. Just read the article, and then what we are doing in some sense is spanning the space of this low dimensional manifold and collecting samples all over it. Okay, so this is the first part, and then each sample is about, as I said before, like 10 to 15 k, and we reduce the dimensionality. Now comes the relearning part, or actually the second stage of the learning. Now we take certain labeled samples, which are what we want to learn. So we want to learn what is the digit 0, when it is being spoken by the person. So each digit is a set of samples of high dimensional space, which are now extended into our low dimensional manifold. So this is the point where we use the extension operator. So this is a set of different occurrences where the person in question says 0, and now each of them is extended into my low dimensional representation, using the extension operator. Now, when I want to identify, so approximately here, this is the end of the, not approximately, exactly, this is the end of the learning stage. Now I want to recognize something. So I take a few samples, which I believe are one word, and then I do exactly the same thing. I extend them over the manifold, and now I have to compare them to the signatures I already have. And the way we compare them here, I'll just compare the distance between the sets using the Hausdorff distance. Later in the talk, in the second hour, I'll introduce a better similarity measure for sets, which provides much better performance. But that's not really important at this point. All we have said is that a particular object is made out of a number of high-dimensional samples, a set of samples, and are now down-projected into a low-dimensional space where it is quite easy to compute distances. I mean, we could have done everything in the high-dimensional space here, in the original one, but then nothing works. And also, it's much more difficult to do. So just to show you some of the results, and this kind of identification is still quite mediocre compared to other speech recognition schemes. Just want to give you a hint that in speech recognition, no one actually needs this kind of algorithms. Why? Because they have a natural way of computing a low-dimensional presentation, which is related to what is called LFC coefficients. So in certain areas, people have already defined parametric approaches to finding low-dimensional presentations. So in that sense, this is just an exercise, but it comes out to the most important theme in machine learning. Don't learn what you already know. So in certain fields, you don't need to go all this way and do a non-parametric reduction of your dimensionality. Sometimes it took people about 20 to 30 years to find a nice way of doing that on their own. And for instance, in the speech recognition community, they already have a set of filters, okay, which take you to about the dimensionality of, depending on the number used, between 14 and 30. Okay? So we can, at some point we thought about actually going to that community and trying to apply this scheme there, so then I will not apply it to the original data set, the raw data set, with some small processing. I'll have to go and apply it to what is called MLFC, or also we can use new coefficients and so on. So in many applications, you don't start with the raw data. As I said before, when I described the distance measure, you already have some nice representations which are targeted in that particular data set. So as I said before, we did minimal pre-processing of the data and went from individual data from 16,000 to about R10, and also used the Hausdorff distance.
So what are these numbers inside?
This is the recognition rate. So say you had the person said the word, the digit one, so we had a 99% recognition rate for that. Okay? And also the same for audio. Nowadays, I found there is a new repository in the UK. Someone constructed this kind of database, but about 30 to 40 times as large, with a lot of data, exactly the same way we did. And it is being used for speech recognition, audio-visual speech recognition. So the thing we wanted to do next is to use this approach to use different data sources at the same time, where to unify them. And with multi-sensor data, the idea is that although each data source is completely different, at some point it corresponds to the same manifold. And here, that's an example from Michal Irani's paper, about sensor fusion in computer vision. You see that these are the same two images. This is, I think, a SAR image, and that's an IR image, or vice versa, I don't remember, but for a human being, a human observer, it's easy to see that both of them correspond to the same manifold. Now, what is this manifold is completely unknown to me. How do you define it? I don't know. I just believe that, or we believed at the time, that if you will apply and not parametric approach, because if you know how to get to that manifold parametrically, that's obviously the thing to do, but here it's not as obvious as that, that we will be able to use multi-sensor data. So we didn't work on images like that, we worked on the audio visual data, and that's the main idea. And here we have to use the density invariant embedding, because we cannot assume that completely different sensors, for instance here, the physics behind each of these sensors is completely different. This image, I think that this is IR. IR is actually resembles an image, the way it is acquired. SAR actually is the result of some computational procedure. So we have, so obviously, these two data sources sample our information source completely differently in the sense of its density. So now if you would like to unify these two sources and get some synergy, what we'll have to do is, first of all, use a density invariant embedding, and then append both of them. What we did later also is to put in a weighting scheme. So here I'm just saying that I'm taking each source differently and using them together, but also, if we have a particular target in mind, say classification, I can learn the weights. What are the weights? I can weight differently the contribution of one sensor versus the other. For that, I have to have some kind of objective function to optimize. So in general, I don't know the weights, but if I'm interested, say, in pattern recognition, I can just optimize those weights. In machine learning, you'll call it learn the weights, okay? Now, when we do that, we get a very nice phenomenon. We actually see that when we use both of them, so we use both cues at the same time, the recognition rate goes up significantly. So, and actually, this is what we expected to see. We hope to see that certain digits which are easily distinguished by the audio signal would be improved if for other digits we also use the visual information. So sometimes one cue is not sufficient. This is what we see here. But when we use the both of them, we just get a better recognition rate. Not known. The most dangerous thing with non-parametric data analysis is to try to attribute meaning to the embeddings you get. Sometimes, like the example of the rotating end, you get exactly a monotonic function of the rotating end. In most cases, I mean, maybe if you look at the data and the positions that the mouth takes at the digit six, maybe it would be easier to see. So, but it's very difficult in most cases to infer from non-parametric analysis what went on in the original data set. That's my experience, so I really don't know. Obviously, if you really want to optimize over there, we naturally chose a very simple pattern recognition scheme. So if you want to optimize over there, do feature selection in that space, in the unified reduced space, you can do that. Probably it will solve that problem, okay? Because you can train over that. I suppose that if I just choose the weights optimally here, as you said here, I'll probably get at least that thing, okay? So if I just put in the weights as we did recently, we'll probably get at least 0.93 and not 0.9.
I'm a little confused
what
you did there. So are you saying that the data you had is, so someone says six and you have their mouth as well, and that whole thing is one piece of data, or do you just have a bunch of people saying six, and then a bunch of mouths visually, and you don't have them simultaneously?
We have a certain person saying six.
Yes.
Now, when we do that, we break the signal into small parts. So, and I'll get that in a few slides. This is what we call a gestalt approach, in contrast to a holistic approach. So, a person starts here and ends here in 7, and he says 6. That's a particular person. Only one person is used to train the machine, right. And then only that data is fed into it. Now, this is also broken up into small pieces. So this is 1 over 25 FPS, so that's like 40 milliseconds. So for 40 milliseconds, we get two cues. One is the image, and here we get an audio sequence, which is just sound. Okay, so the entire recognition is taking this set of approximately 20 to 30 samples, and then I identify them in contrast to to the set we have in our learning set. Okay, and in particular, we have several learning sets for each digit over which we just use all of them.
But in the learning set, you have you pair together the visual and the audio data from each piece. So it's not that you have some visual stuff and some audio stuff and you're merging them.
No, they are synchronized.
All right.
They are synchronized. If we want to synchronize, we have to go to the first algorithm I showed, which is where you have the same manifold and then you try to sync both of them. Using geometry. In practice, it's very difficult because these kind of transforms are non-linear. So it might be that the relationship between the two manifolds, which are supposed to be the same, is quite distorted.
Yes.
So it's not like a thing I do on real data. It's more like a proof of concept that we get the same a manifold, which is very similar. There are some ways of finding a mapping between those two, but I'll leave it at that at this point of time. Actually, there are. It's related to the following issue. Just grab like 2 minutes. If you try to learn a metric, so it's like we have this data set, and it's exactly the same way we have here. So we have a certain data set, and now there are two metrics. You just measure the distance in two different approaches. One, for instance, the most prominent application is just kind of a numerical approach. Just take the L2 distance. The second one is subjective. You take a bunch of people and you tell them to provide scores. Then again, you get two sets which are supposed to correspond to the same manifold, but are completely different. So now we are looking for a mapping from one manifold to the other. And if we can solve that, we can try and do things like find what is a metric for beauty, because we can learn the metric at one point and then extend into it. And then there are ways we're trying to do that, but it's a little bit tricky because of the nonlinearity. So it's a very important application, this going from one manifold to the other. So the second approach, which is basically the numerical computation is actually exactly the same as before. I'm referring now to the embedding scheme. But this is a different approach to analyzing spectral embeddings using the graph Laplacian as the kernel is that when we start with the same matrix W as we had before, here instead of writing D, I say, you see, you have the square. So it's basically the same thing, but now I'm looking at this Markov matrix and computing its eigenvectors. So it's important to say the eigenvectors of this Markov matrix and those of the graph Laplacian are exactly the same. So we're doing the same thing. The interpretation is different. So what we are doing here is taking a data set and inducing an artificial Markov walk over it. So the data set knows nothing about a Markov walk. It's not a result of a Markov walk. If it is, it becomes something else, which I'll say in a few words later. But in general, it's just a numerical tool. So we induce a Markov walk and we look at its asymptotic regime. So the asymptotic regime is characterized by the eigenvectors. So numerically, it's exactly the same as before. It just provides us now with a new way of analyzing our data, understanding what we are doing to the data using these kind of algorithms. And about, I would say, like 5, 6, 7 years ago, that was the prevailing approach to the analysis of such embeddings in the machine learning community. And I'll just give a few references. There are many, many more. I mean, like the textbook is Chung's book on spectral graph theory, and the notion which was given there and many other, obviously, many other things is the idea of the mixing time of the Markov random chain. So this idea was later used in many papers. The main question people asked initially is, why is this working? Why, if we take a data set, it uses this Markov random walk, take the eigenvectors, and cluster the data using this eigenvector, why does it work so well? And the first answer to that question, based on the Markov approach, was given by Shi and Mela, and there they didn't give a general answer. They just said the following thing. Say you had a very particular Markov chain in question. So once you analyze your data, you got a very particular Markov chain, one which is lampable. A lampable Markov chain means that the Markov matrix is built out of blocks. Can be, if you reorder it, you get piecewise constant blocks. Then the eigenvectors are also piecewise constant, and then they provide you with the optimal cluster. So this is not a general result. It just tells you why there is a certain sense in using them. And a prime mathematician or an engineer would say that that a lot of data in general can be approximated by lampable Markov chains. That's like the view which is expressed in this work. There are also other works by Michael Jordan and Andrew Eng and Yale Weiss, several papers where they studied the stability of this approach. So this is why does it work, and here it says why is it robust. Okay. And the most recent contribution along that line was done by Stefanin and Koifman, which combines both the Markov approach and actually the point where I started with spectral embeddings, which tells us what is the metric induced over the data. If you recall, spectral embeddings in general, using a general kernel, positive centered kernel K, induce a certain metric over our data. So they gave an answer to the question, what is the metric being induced when we embed our data using the graph Laplacian? And it comes out to be something called the diffusion distances. And so the L2 distance in the embedding space approximates this quantity. If you take all the eigenvectors, you get exactly this term. Usually we just take a few, so we approximate it. So what does it mean? It means that if I look at the probabilities of this artificial Markov walk, the one I've induced over the data, so the distance delta distance in the embedding space is just the distance in transition, in Markov transition probability. Say I take B and C, so the L2 distance here, it's just when I sum all the distances in transition probabilities between C and A minus the transition from B to A, and do this, so this is what we have here, and I sum up over all possible data points in my set. This term is just the left eigenvector of the Markov matrix, so it is just the asymptotic density. Okay, so it's a kind of normalization. So if I have more points here, it gives equal weight to different parts of my data set. So why was that important? How could we use that? So I'll just say again, as I said before, already said that it gives answers to different questions. So together with Amit and Rafi, we studied the following problem. And that's the issue. So say we are given a time series. Time series, say it's even a finite time series. And again, we use this data of speech recognition. So say we are given that type of data. And what we would like is to build a model, a Markov model of that data source. And we would like to do it in a data-driven way. So what we do, as we did before, is to start with defining or analyzing the signal as a whole. So at first, we don't care about pattern recognition as a task. We just want to build a model, a Markov model for the data. So the first part is to embed the data into a low dimensional space and then reduce the number of possible states. So just to remind you, when we use spectral embedding and view it from a Markov point of view, each sample point is considered a Markov state. And this is what we have here. So what we would like to do next is to decimate or to quantize the number of states. The reason we can do it and claim some optimality is because of the diffusion distances. So we know that the L2 distances in the embedding space, they correspond to distances between probabilities. So if we want to quantize it in, with some hope of optimality or understanding what the quantization, what is the result of the quantization, we want to be able to optimize a certain criteria. And here the criteria is simple, it's just the L2 distance between the points. So when we do k-means here, we're quantizing our set of states, we're minimizing the discrepancy in terms of diffusion distances. So we started with 6,000 points and went down to about 10 states, what we call 10 meta states. Now it is extremely easy to learn a Markov model. So I already have all of the states. I know what are the coordinates of these states. I can just go back and run the entire signal over these states, and I can easily compute now the probabilities of each state in this data set, and also the transition probabilities. So just to make that clear, we use the entire data set to compute all of this reduced set of states. Now say I want to identify what is the digit zero. I take a sequence which is a person saying the digits zero. I run it through the system, and then I can compute transition probabilities. I can also compute state probabilities. I can do all of that in a data-driven way. The only thing which we have to know from the get-go is the bandwidth of the signal, of the kernel. Okay, that's the epsilon in that. So just to relate it to other works in machine learning, this is similar to the bag of words approach in text analysis and so forth. Yeah, I get you. So, okay, so the last slide for now is just to say that once we have that, we can compute a maximum likelihood classifiers, and actually it gives us nice results. So sorry for glitching a little bit, and see you after.